guys. Welcome back to this episode of Pacific Tuesday on the Newsprint Commando site, feed, podcast, whatever you want to call it. My name's Ed Moore. I'm your host. If you want to send feedback, you can find me on Blue Sky and Twitter, STO Productions. You can tweet the show at NewsPCommando on Twitter. I am IndieMan@gmail.com is the email address. Indie is spelled I-N-D-I-E. And the website, comicbooknoise.com/TNC, Tango November Charlie, TNC. We're going to be looking at the books published by Pacific Comics on, in, or around July of 1983. 8 books. So this episode, let's say, is going to be broken up into parts, probably about 3 different parts as I try to keep them all to a manageable size as far as listening. So first up, we're looking at Bernie Wrightson's Master of the Macabre, number 3. Now, the cover is created for us by Bernie and Steve Olaf. Bernie Wrightson did the pencils and inks, Olaf the colors. And it is of The Hag. It actually has its own title. You can find it reproduced in Monsters of Color, the Creature Book, put out by Phil Suling in 1974. Actually, I meant to look that book up, but I forgot. I'm not sure what it is, if it's just a book of art or what exactly it is. When I get done recording here, I'll look it up and, well, I won't be able to tell you then because it'll be too late, won't it? There you go. Let's see. The first story is entitled King of the Mountain, and it is scripted, penciled, and inked for us by Bernie Wrightson, colored by Steve Olaf. And this book that I'm looking at is the reprint of other stories. So these stories originally showed up in other places. Case in point, this story first was published in Bad Time Stories, put out by Graphic Masters in 1972. Curious little story. It puts me in mind, the character puts me in mind of Journey, The Adventures of Wolverine McAllister, that was created by William Misner Loebs and put out by Aardvark Vanaheim about the same time, I think the mid to early 80s, 82, 84, something like that. This character kind of puts me in mind of that. He's the mountain man wearing buckskin. He's got an old, almost looks like a flintlock, but I don't believe it is. I believe it's a repeating rifle. And the very first image, first, the inside cover has an editorial by Bruce Jones where he catches us up on some of his interactions with Bernie Wrightson, who, of course, is the focus of the book. Okay, now, the first page of the story, King of the Mountain, this mountain dude who never gets a name is beating the stuffing out of a more typical city-dwelling tails. Looks like the dude has tails on, a coat with tails, got spats on. So he's some sort of dandy out here in the woods. I don't understand that. And this mountain man has just killed him to take all of his stuff, which includes gold dust, liquor, L-I-K-K-E-R, liquor, and a female Native American Indian, whatever the appropriate term is. I don't want to offend anyone, so I'm not entirely sure how the reference is accepted nowadays. Native American woman, and it's a younger woman and drawn very attractively by Mr. Wrightson, I might add. So now this mountain man has claimed his winnings, as it were, having killed the previous possessor of these items. And over time, he's figuring out what he's going to do. So the first thing that he's going to do is take all of this into town and trade in the gold dust that he got. Well, it turns out, first off, the rifle that he beat this other man to death with was the other man's rifle. So when this mountain man goes to use the rifle doesn't work. So he gets all upset and smashes the rifle and jumps up and down, stomps it, breaks it, whatever. He asks the Native American woman, now his companion, for a bottle of the liquor because he wants to drown his sorrows at this point. So he grabs a bottle and tastes it. It doesn't doesn't taste good. So he goes through the liquor, bottle over bottle over bottle, trying them to see. And he can't find one that tastes any good. So he's got a handful left and he just throws them out, figuring that they all are bad. So that's two things now that he's gotten from this guy that didn't work out. So they continue on. His load is quite a bit lighter, right? Because he's gotten rid of this rifle. He's gotten rid of a big container of the alcohol that the dude was carrying. Now all he has is the bag of gold dust and the Native American woman. So he goes in to exchange the gold dust for money and finds out that it's nothing but sand. I'm starting to wonder, you know, what the point of the story is at this point. So there's three things that he won, right, by defeating this other man, and all of them are bogus things. None of them seem real. None of them function properly. They're not what they're supposed to be. I'm kind of lost at this point. I don't know. I guess I'm just dense because truly by the end of the story, I still didn't get it. I don't get the point. Now, the artwork is spot on. It's pretty to look at. For me, it was very dumb to read, but it was pretty to look at. So anyways, we continue on. He finds out that the sand is not gold dust, and he objects to the person that he gave the dust to weigh it and everything like that. He says that they are lying to him. Well, they call in some of their muscle because, of course, this being an exchange service, things happen. So the person making the exchange has muscle in case this type of situation arises. Well, the mountain man loses. He's outweighed. He's out everything. He's thrown out. So now all he has left is the Native American woman. Well, she's over picking up some of his stuff, and she's bent over, and she is drawn from the back as the mountain man would be looking at her. And he kind of gets this idea, and he looks over at the camera to acknowledge to us that, well, you know, he still has something good here left. So he tells the woman, I got you, woman. Take off your clothes. And she takes off all her clothes. We see from behind, not much. We see her tush, and that's about it. And he walks away shaking his head saying, oh, Lord, this just ain't been my day. And I just, like I say, from the back, it looks like a typical female. I don't understand. Yeah, so I don't get it. Bernie, right? That's who wrote this? Yeah, Bernie, whatever your point was. And I know Bernie's dead now. Thanks. I don't know. I don't get it, dog. So, yeah, moving on. Next page is an advert for Silver Heels by Bruce Jones and Scott Compton. And it's got about a quarter of a page write-up as to what the story is about and how it came to be and things like that. I do have it on my list to cover probably next season of the Pacific Tuesday shows. I think next season. I don't think I'll have a chance to cover it in the remainder of this season in 1983 coverage. It's not just 1983 coverage because it spans years, but there's a couple months left in this season of my coverage, and I don't think it's in there. I think it's in the next season, which will finish up Pacific Comics. All right, second story. This is an anthology book, by the way, Bernie Wright's in Master of the Macabre, and it had four shorter stories in it. So this second story is entitled A Martian Song. And it is scripted for us by Nicola Cuti with pencils and inks by Bernie Wrightson and colors by Steve Olaf. This story originally appeared in Creepy number 87 from 1977. Now, the thing that I noticed right off is that the reproduction in this book is in color. And off the top of my head, I thought the Creepy and the Eeries from, who was that, Harris? And Vampirella at this time. I thought those were all black and white, just line work. I don't know. Maybe if I find a copy of this, I'll look and be able to tell you definitively. For those of you that are listening, you may know about Creepy number 87, but I always assumed that all of those books were in black and white. Well, this has full color in it. Interestingly designed, though, it is a 6. It's 6 pages. Each page has 4 vertical panels, divided up evenly, and the text, the narration, is from our protagonist's point of view. He is our narrator, our POV as well, and it is in rhyme, like a short stanza of a poem, each vertical panel. So the panels show an Earth man, we'll say, someone from Earth that has apparently crash-landed on another planet. And if you'll bear with me, I think I'll go ahead and just read this poetry as we go along to you. It's pretty short. Starts out, I had come to the land of the pale ochre sand where God shines his eye dim and cold. And he's walking away across a landscape here. Where the air, though it's thin, kicks a hell of a wind which cuts through the tears in my clothes. And we see an image of him, and he's got a mask on. So the atmosphere on this planet is not too human liking, so he needs assistance. Otherwise, he's wearing some gloves and a coat. He doesn't have anything on his head or his face or anything like that, just a breathing mask. Third panel, page one. In the great Hela's bowl, great yellow clouds roll. They swirl round a silver obelisk. He's up on a bluff overlooking, and he sees this big silver metallic-looking spire down below him. Once a ship, now a tomb for my crew, for me soon, well, we all were aware of the risk. So this is his ship he's looking at as he's looking over. He has walked the perimeter, maybe looking for something, and he's come back to his quote-unquote home. Second page, first panel. There's no reason to stay. Rescue's 2 weeks away, and I've only 3 days' worth of air. Okay, so there's a slight dilemma. He won't be alive when help arrives. So I'll see what I can of this desolate land. The direction I go, I don't care. And he takes off walking in a direction, like he said. Sure, there's clouds in the sky, but the seas are bone dry, because nowhere on Mars does it rain. So we find out. This is the first manned mission to Mars. The atmosphere is such that he needs assistance breathing. He's only got 3 days left. He's got 2 weeks to wait for rescue. The oceans have dried up, which Mars is constantly in the news today, actually, as I record this, about new findings. And it is believed that there once was liquid water, I think, on Mars. I think that's pretty commonly accepted by this point. Hills and craters abound on the smooth desert ground, but most of the land is the same, as he continues to trudge on. Then I come to a plain, laminated terrain where the ground into layers was pressed, and he's on another bluff looking over life. There are other hominid-like beings down in the valley below him. On the rust-colored land camped a nomadic band. In tough leather hides they were dressed. They were fleshy and plump, round faces, full rumps, but their bodies were as solid as clay. He's now walking into the camp, and they are noticing him. They laughed at the man who breathed air from a can, but in gestures they bid me to stay. Corralled was a beast for some future feast, and it seemed that it knew of that fate. For as I came near, it bellowed with fear and kicked till it broke down the gates. It charged into the clan and tore up a man, then turned to a girl near my side. While the tribesmen were stunned, I unholstered my gun and burned a hole through its hide. So, there's a creature that's going to be eaten, and it's a rather ferocious-looking creature to just be food. But it breaks loose, and it starts killing the tribe's people. And as it turns to kill a female, our protagonist, our narrator here, finally pulls a gun and kills the beast. As the beast heaved and bled, moaning, dying, then dead, the girl that I saved came to me. Her face so serene, her onyx eyes gleamed like the moon on a glittering sky. Uh-oh. She was a girl I had known in the green fields of home. She was each girl from out of my past. The first girl I kissed, the one that I missed, the best, the others, the last. So he's remembering his life through this girl as his time is coming to an end because he doesn't have enough oxygen. With a childlike charm, she accepted my arm, for she understood my desire. Neath oilskin dome, we were both all alone as our nakedness shined in the fire. They get busy. I thanked all the stars for this one night on Mars, for the beauty so firm and so fair. As we locked in embrace, horror twisted my face. Damnation, I ran out of air. So he didn't run out of air while they were doing the deed. Apparently she had left and then came back and found that he had pulled the mask off because he was suffering to try to get that last gasp of air and to see if he could breathe it, since these other people were, and apparently not, because the final panel was him laying half covered in skins with the mask laying on his chest from where he took it off. So interesting, just interesting format. Vertical panels, poetry, prose, if you will. I guess that's what it's called. I don't know. I'm not a literature person, but rhyming, that's cool. Next page is an ad for Pacific Comics. Six different books here advertised. Of them, Vanguard and Somerset Holmes, we haven't yet talked about. Now, the first issue of Somerset Holmes is up for discussion a little bit later in this month's coverage, July. Vanguard is, I think, next season. All right. Third story, Nightfall, scripted by Bill Dubay, penciled and inked by Bernie Wrights, and colored by Steve Olaf. This is reproduced from Erie, number 60, 1974. This, too, obviously, because there was a colorist, is in full color. So we have a young man. His name is Nemo. He is terrorized at night by a monster, Igor. And that's I-G-O-R. I guess it's pronounced Igor. Well, whenever Igor shows up, the child Nemo screams for one or the other or both parents. It happens night after night, and when the parent comes in, the light shows that whatever it is he thought was the monster was not. A broom in a corner, his clothes thrown across a chair, toys piled up in the corner. One night when his dad comes in, keeps getting worse and worse, more and more monsters every time he sees him, not just Igor, until finally Igor and his, looks like a quartet of monsters, picks up the boy's bed and is starting to drag the bed physically to the open window, and I guess they're going to throw him out the window, I'm not sure. They get the bed most of the way out of the window, but his screaming and yelling finally brings his parents. His mom comes in and says, "What's this? Why'd you put your bed out the window, young man? This is the last straw." And I mean, you look at this kid, there's no way that he got this window to the, or this bed to the window. I mean, it's just not, it's a huge four-poster bed. Yeah. So they won't believe what their eyes are seeing for whatever reason. "I'll give you a thrashing of your nut." "John, wait. He's really frightened." Nemo says, "Mama, they're here. They're here. The monsters really are here waiting for me, waiting in the dark." She says, "All right, young man." Dad says, "You can come sleep with us tonight, but just tonight. Tomorrow, you'll learn that there's nothing in the dark that'll hurt you." After the parents leave, narration bubbles coming out of the darkened corner of the room. One says, "It's okay, Igor. We get him. We get him tomorrow night." So, there we go. Irony, I guess they call that. Next page is an advert for Full Color Portfolios from Shanes and Shanes, who is the office of Pacific that does fine art stuff at the time. And you have the possibility of ordering one of, or however many of, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11 portfolios. Two of them are ElfQuest. Two of them are heavy metal. So they've got some coolness here. And they show all of them but one that is listed here. So the ElfQuest is an ElfQuest 3. So it's the third portfolio. I don't know if that Shanes and Shanes has produced or that has been produced. But what stands out to me is you can get it either signed for $25 or unsigned for $12. And I don't know. 12 portraits, the ElfQuest. 9.5 by 12.5. 12 of them for $12. So you can get 12 prints for $1 a piece of ElfQuest stuff from Warp Graphics. Wow. That's awesome. All right. The fourth and final story in this issue of Bernie Wrights and Master of the Macabre is The Last Hunters. Scripted, penciled, and inked by Bernie Wrights and colored by Steve Olaf. This also appeared in Bad Time Stories that came out in 1972 by Graphic Masters. Looks to be the same book as the King of the Mountain story. So there we are. I tried to find some other information about it. I did see that there are copies available on eBay going for a mint. Anywhere from 75 to 100 to 100 and a quarter. Looks like finalized bids. So it's relatively hard to come by. I guess it's so expensive because it must be all Bernie Wrightson stuff. Another interesting layout, this one from Bernie Wrightson. The previous was by Bill Dubay. Although it could be that Bernie Wrightson was responsible for the layout and it too being the artist. But this one, basically what this has is every page is divided horizontally, upper and lower portion. Now, sometimes the panels for a half are anywhere from 1 to 3 panels in any given half. But they vary. The first page actually is a 3/4 page splash. But you have, as you go through the story, you have 2 panels. You have 3 up, 2 down, 2 up, 1 down, 1 up, 2 down, 1 up, 2 down, 3 up, 1 down. So the visualness, I guess, of the story really changes. In the middle, you have the narration box. And that's what it is. It's all narration. It's not text. And this is an omniscient third-person narration. Yeah. So it's not anybody that's... Well, let me see. Yeah. It's not anybody that's involved in the story. So it's a neutral observer narrating for us. We start out somewhere where there are ruins. The ruins kind of look like something we should know. I don't know if it could be structures. To me, it kind of looks like sailing vessels, like sailing vessels. I'm not sure if it's supposed to be that specific or if it's just ruins of buildings. But we have some creatures, and one of them has either a staff or a spear as they're sitting out looking over some polluted kind of water at these ruins. The next panel, one is kind of bemoaning, I think, his fate to the moon that is rising in the distance. A couple are hunting, and one of them has gotten a small squid, it looks like, for dinner. We see that the weather is changed such that it rains acid. And so these creatures have to try to find shelter, and if they don't, they die. They're melted. So there's been some... at the very least, ecological disaster on this planet, if not inhabitant-created disaster that has caused... Well, I would think. It could be that acidic rains are a natural occurrence. I don't know. My science tends to say no, but it could be a natural occurrence. I would be curious how life started under those conditions, though. Okay. So we see these creatures. They live a hand-to-mouth life. Things are difficult to come by. Children that are born die soon after they're born. So this is a diminishing population on its own, much less with any other pressures from outside, which we see here because now as a group of these creatures are trudging along in their life, there is some other humanoid creature with a weapon that fires on them from above as they're passing by and kills, looks like, all of this small little troop. Well, he goes down to inspect his work, and you can't really tell at the time, but apparently he takes a trophy and heads back up over a couple mountain ranges and whatnot to what appears to be a city now, an actual not abandoned, not destroyed city, a functioning working city. All we see, though, is this one inhabitant, so we don't know if he or she is the last or not, but it is living in this city. And it goes in, and you see it inspecting the trophies, and the trophies are multiple heads of these very same creatures that we have seen since the beginning of the story. And this individual takes off, harnesses its weapon, takes off its outerwear, and you see that it's kind of the meshing of flesh and mechanics. And he surveys the wall, and you see it finally, and it looks to be not quite as grotesque example of this same species. So apparently some members of this species, after, we'll say, this ecological disaster, stayed safe and advanced. Some that were caught in amongst it regressed as far as their physiology. And the haves spend time hunting the have-nots. And that's where the society has gotten to. The artwork was excellent. I enjoyed the artwork quite a bit. King of the Mountain, I didn't understand. The Martian Saga was okay. Nightfall was okay. The Last Hunters, I think, was okay. Just that first one. Starting off the book with a story that I didn't understand kind of put me in a foul mood by the time I got done with it. You know, I wish they had kind of put that to the end. That way I would have enjoyed the book until the end, which I didn't understand. Would have been okay. But starting off with something I didn't get kind of put me off. Not the visuals, though. Bernie Wrightson. I dig Bernie Wrightson. I think, and she's not here to speak on this, but I think Bernie Wrightson will turn out to be one of my wife's favorite artists, too. She was very taken with the Frankenstein work that he did, and early on in our relationship, and early on, thus, in her true comic book exposure, she grew up reading, you know, things like the Hot Stuff and Archie and, you know, stuff like that. But the superhero-y and the horror science fiction and stuff that I read, some of her first exposure to it led her to seeing Bernie Wrightson and becoming a fan, I think, of that Frankenstein work. So I think in general, she's kind of a Wrightson fan. We podcast together, but we haven't really done any Wrightson books. So I don't necessarily know that to be 100% true, but I think it is. Okay, that's a little bit too much about me. So moving on, we'll take a look at Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers number 12. This cover is by Jack Kirby and inked by Mike Thibodeau. And I will say, I don't know how often I've brought this up, but when I decide for Newsprint Commando books that I want to cover, I do my utmost to, if I don't have, acquire actual copies of the books that I talk about. I think it's only fair. Rather than, I'm not a fan of collected editions necessarily. I certainly am not a fan of, well, I want to buy them because they look pretty on my shelf, which really seems to be a motivating factor, and I don't understand that. I think that giving the books their due, I have to hold them. I have to smell them, which I do continuously, honestly. See them, their actual colors and everything like that. I have a better appreciation of them. So, saying that, most of these books, I think so far I've only encountered one book that I was not able to acquire, and that's because I just was not willing to pay the price, to be honest. And I've been looking at some of the books to finish up my Pacific coverage, and they're starting to trend that way a little bit more. So I don't know how long I'll be able to buy the individual books to talk about without having to go to collected editions or borrowing the books from people I know that have them or something like that. Okay, sorry about that. Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers 12. The cover is penciled by Jack Kirby, and it is inked by Mike Thibodeau. This is the cover is a young Captain Victory, and a gentleman here that we will find out is Captain Argus Flane, F-L-A-N-E. And looks like they're being attacked from off-panel by projectile weapons that are coming at them. That's quasi-true as far as part of the story. Not exactly. We're told here on the cover, Origin 2, this is the second issue of his origin, end of the boy, beginning of the man, in defense of our galaxy, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers. So, Rangers, yeah, sorry. So we finish up the origin story of the captain here that began in issue 11. Inside front cover, available now from Pacific Comics, Silver Heels number 1. Yeah, that's not exactly true necessarily. Yeah, not that I found. It's not available yet, but it will be. Origin 2 of Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers, the first story page. And this is brought to us, scripted and penciled by Jack Kirby, inked by Mike Thibodeau, colored by Tom Luth, and lettered by Pelle Jensen. So we see that the young Captain Victory is being spoken to by Tarai, the intelligent computer, the artificial intelligence conscious computer in his dad's ship. That's where this young Captain Victory is. Well, it turns out that he and this computer are in cahoots. The computer is helping him escape and get away from his father and the pirate conqueror life that Victory has been living and no longer wants to do. So he came up with a plan with this sentient computer, and they're enacting it. He is getting away, but he is waylaid by his grandfather, who he calls Black Mass. And he appears as just a non-corporeal shadow on the wall. And that truly is the only form he has. Physically, he is unable to stop Victory, even though he wants to. And the young lad gives him some grief and tells him how disgusting it is that just to prolong his life, he turned into and accepted this type of existence of being just this living shadow. Victory heads on out, talking all the way with this sentient computer, Tarai, until finally Victory is able to leave on a very Kirby-esque one-man sled while the ship explodes in the background. And we're told Tarai's work was apocalyptic in nature. During those last moments, he struck with a mammoth force which not only destroyed him, but twisted and battered time and space in manners unheard of. Wow. Very profound. So, a two-page spread here for this, where the narration is that I just read. Beautiful, colorful Jack Kirby. Very Kirby-esque sled, one-man sled that Victory is riding here. I've seen very similar machineries in other Kirby pieces, so it's a concept that he's a fan of as far as the design of this single-man conveyance. Moving on, we start to see the young man as he's flying through space and he's encountering different aspects of space, thinking to himself, and the omniscient narrator narrating both to us and to Victory to some extent. Some of the text is directed at Victory or what he's doing, what he's thinking. So Victory continues on until he comes near a planet, but something happens and the ship, the little conveyance vehicle, air motorcycle, whatever you want to call it, that he's on, ends up crashing and being destroyed. Victory lands, finds himself attacked, so he quickly draws cover, finds that the attack is coming from behind him, which is kind of surprising. He didn't even know they were there. But then as he notices that, he is then attacked from the other side. Having been attacked from the other side, he surmises that he has found himself in a no man's land. And actually, the two sides are attacking each other. He's just caught in the middle. He does manage to come in contact with and speak to the individual attacking the second side. And that turns out to be Captain Argus Flayne. So he is attacking these creatures, and the creatures are attacking him. Turns out that Flayne crashed on this planet too. I don't know if there's a connection to Victory crashing, if it's something that happens when you get too close or not, or just circumstantial. But Flayne is here, he has crashed, and he has been, quote-unquote, I'll explain that here in a minute, fighting these native inhabitants of this planet. Now, what's been happening, Flayne crashed, and he is unable to leave, so it seems. And so he's been trying to eke out an existence on this planet with these creatures attacking him. In turn, he has been playing with the creatures, helping them advance technologically and via machines of war, so that each time they attack, they're better. They attack with better weaponry, better tactics, what have you. We find out that, well, actually, Flayne could leave the planet if he really, really wanted to, but he got tired of the life he was living and so went to just zooming around space when he crashed on this planet. He took that as a sign that he had done everything that he could do, and so he was willing to just stay on this planet until he ended. He is now using this increasing ability of these native creatures to attack him as the impetus pushing him closer and closer to his demise, which he is okay with because he knows that at some point he will push them past his ability to defend himself. He will give them technology and they will advance that technology beyond what he can protect himself. And at that point, they will overwhelm him and he'll be killed. But the thing is this happens over a period of years. Now, maybe it told us, I think 6 or 7 was an age that we heard about Victory in the previous issue. I don't know what the age is when he finally leaves his father's ship. He does turn 18 when he's on this planet with Flayne. He turns 21 when he's on this planet. So there's at least 3 years right there. And definitely I suspect more because he said when he was 18. So at some point on this planet, he was not 18. So he's been here longer than 3 years. We don't know exactly how much. We start to see that the area of devastation from the attacks on Flayne keeps growing. The area, so the ability to cause destruction by this native species is increasing. The vessel, and now the underground portion, because Flayne expanded underground, is very well protected. And so Flayne and Victory live there just fine. Victory grows and grows and grows until he feels that he has learned and seen everything he can here. He decides he's going to take off, which we find out he can do. He is able to leave, which means Flayne would have been able to also, but chose not to. So Victory's going to leave, and because Flayne really doesn't have anything left to protect but himself, when Victory leaves, he lowers his defenses and lets this alien species have the final attack. And they finally do, and they kill him. That, then, is the end of basically the origin story for Captain Victory, because we revert back to the dreadnought here that he commands, the dreadnought tiger, and we see the many alien species that he's been telling this tale to, which is where the tale started. And we resume the normal working on the dreadnought tiger, what have you. So things return to normal after this little story. Next page, we see the big Maasai Goliath of the Ghetto, Silver Star issue number 4, on sale now, which Silver Star is not one of this month's books, so maybe it's next month. Silver Star number 4, rather. Next page is a full-page advert for Freak Wave, Breaks This Summer in Vanguard number 1 by Peter Milligan and Brendan McCarthy from Pacific Comics. That'll be next season. A Conrad Thrillology is the next page. Tim Conrad is one of today's most highly regarded graphic story illustrators. That also will come up next season of the Pacific Cast, Pacific Comics Cast, Pacific Tuesdays, whatever you or I want to call them. All right, our third and final story is entitled An Eye, or it's the second story, I'm sorry, An Eye for an Eye. And this comes to us scripted by Bruce Jones, penciled, inked, colored, and lettered by Kent Williams. And it's a earthly pirate tale. We have Capspan, who finds Rupert's, who has been cast adrift, and Capspan brings him aboard the ship. Captain Varley is the captain of the ship. I'm sorry, not Rupert's. Hans Cyrus is the gentleman that was overboard, that was brought onto Captain Varley's ship. And he is being seen to by Capspan. We see Cyrus's story. He was mate on a ship. They reached an island where they decided they were going to stay for a little while. There was an indigenous population that they could kill and terrorize and rape and do pillage and destroy and what have you. So instead of sailing on the high seas, they decided they would go to ground and do that for a little while. Well, at one point, the captain decided that He was done. So he's going through and killing everyone. He gets to the last dude, who is this dude named Rupert's, and he has a story. A story that he hopes will save his life. He tells the captain of a great treasure located at a great lighthouse in this unexplored, unspoiled portion of the ocean. Shows him roughly on a map. But the captain's like, no, you're not going to send me into trouble and me let you go and everything be okay. You're going to come with us. So you will directly guide us there. And when it's all good, I'll let you go. Or not, who knows. But at least you're not going to die here and now if you show us where this is. So Rupert's does, points in the direction. And after many, many days months, weeks of travel, they see a light, because he told them it was a lighthouse. And so they steer now directly for the light. Well, time after time after time, they find that they're not getting any closer to this lighthouse. And then they start getting a little bit closer, just in very, very small increments. But they keep sailing, keep sailing. Supplies are running low. They keep sailing, because the goal is right there in sight. They just can't seem to get to it. So finally, something breaks, and they start rapidly gaining on the light. And one night, as they're watching, they finally see the image of the lighthouse, and then the image breaks through the fog, and it's a giant sea serpent with a big glowy in the darky eye. So that's the light that they've been following. The sea serpent trashes the ship, kills everyone except Rupert's. Rupert's floats around in the ocean until he's picked up by this other ship, captained by Captain Varley, with Capspan and Mr. Nobbs, actually, it turns out, on it. We then find out that this captain, this whole time, has been heading towards this same lighthouse, and I guess past the wreck of the previous ship that had Rupert's on it, because this Capspan is the dude originally on the first ship that told him about the treasure. He survived, made his way to this ship, and is now leading this ship to the destruction that the ship that Rupert's was on. His captain was Captain Wright. So Captain Wright and Rupert's ship. Come to find out, it's because this Capspan is a devil's familiar, someone that, in league with the great sea dragons, procuring men for the beast in exchange for whatever treasure be aboard the ship. And we know this for certain because on the last page, Capspan, we see, has a little demon's tail hanging out from under his clothing. So it is a story of a story repeating itself. Next page is Bernie Wrightson, Master of the Macabre advert. The inside back cover is a Vanguard Illustrated number 2, which we haven't even gotten to Vanguard issue number 1. Many of these covers are illustrated by Dave Stevens, which unfortunately has been making these very pricey. And then the back cover is of Somerset Holmes, issue number 1, which I will be speaking on later in these episodes for July of 1983. So, typical Kirby stuff. The artwork isn't necessarily Kirby at its best, but it is very Kirby. You get Kirby dots and Kirby energy and Kirby scenes of, make your brain go crazy, and Kirby monsters and creatures and Kirby. It's unfettered Kirby. You know, Kirby's in control. He's doing everything, writing and penciling. So it is what it is. If you like Kirby, it's cool. If you don't, it's probably not your bag. I'm kind of in between at this point. Much more a fan of artwork early Kirby than I am the later Kirby, like the Captain America Joe Simon Kirby or the Everything Marvel Kirby, Avengers, Hulk, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I like that Kirby. This Kirby is near the end of his pretty to my eyeball career anyways. All right, our third book for this first part of the July coverage of Pacific Comics, Edge of Chaos number 2. It is covered by Gray Morrow on pencils and inks and colored by Paul Tallarday, the cover. And the cover is of our protagonist, who is Eric Cleese, related to John Cleese. No, I'm kidding. I don't know if he's related to John Cleese or not. He is running from a woolly mammoth that is chasing him, I think, or maybe the woolly mammoth is part of the attack that Cleese and his comrades are part of, and they're all destroying this city. Maybe that is a more accurate depiction of what this is. The mammoth is knocking down portions of the city after his men have run through and are taking out the guards and whatnot. So I think that's what it is. Kind of a total destruction in waves kind of issue. Inside is scripted, penciled, inked, colored, and lettered by Mr. Gray Morrow. The story is entitled Edge of Chaos. Inside front cover are letters. Steve Sanders, Scott Hampton. That might be somebody that I know, Scott Hampton. Ken Render. And then an editorial piece here by David Scroggie. All right, synopsis. Eric Cleese has been literally yanked out of his own time and transported back to pre-deluge Atlantis. Summoned by the ancient astronauts who first ages ago visited Earth and are trapped there until they can structure some order out of the chaos, their visitation has engendered... Make some order out of the chaos their visitation has engendered. I apologize. This typeface is very difficult. Cleese is entreated to act for them in an effort to terminate the divisive activities of Mad Moloch by whatever means he deems necessary to draw the entire world back from the edge of chaos. Now, the artwork is okay. It's not the best artwork from this time period to my eyes. I had a higher opinion of Gray Morrow from hearing people speak of him until I read this book. Now, as far as his career, I don't know where in his career this artwork is. It is at a point in his career where I am not an appreciator of Gray Morrow's artwork. I can say that. But more than that, I am not an appreciator of his writing, his scripting. It is too full. And then his visuals become too full, trying to keep up with everything that he's doing in the writing. And so everything is too full and too busy, and it's just a lot to keep up with. For example, we have Zaius, who is the god, he's an alien, who is in charge of everything. Then over time, as Zaius's people have been on Earth, they have stratified and segregated into other groups. Okay, of those other groups, Moloch is the leader of the largest group, a group who does not agree with the way Zaius is doing things. They want to be able to have their fun on Earth and do what they want. Zaius has told them that if they do that, and they continue to do that, when the progenitors of Zaius and his people come back to Earth to pick all of them up, which I'm not quite sure I'm understanding why that's happening, they will pick them up, but also destroy everything that is left behind. So if any of Zaius's people, any of humanity, whatever is left that does not want to leave will be destroyed when these progenitors come and take everything. Almost like it's some kind of social experiment that was left in charge, Zaius was left in charge of, and when the progenitors feel that it's done, they'll come and get the overseers and anyone else and anything that's left, they will totally destroy. Okay, so Moloch. Moloch's paramour, Althea, is sick. And to fill her void, he has made a series of robots, none of which he says he can create, but he cannot recreate. So he can make replicas of Althea, but none of them turn out to be like her when pressed. They might look like her, but they don't act or behave like her, and it makes Moloch mad. So periodically, as he's interacting with these doppelgangers, he will destroy them because they don't do or say something that he feels is the way that Althea would do it. So he is trying to control things on Earth. Eric Cleese has been plucked from now and taken to the past, which, like they said, this was pre-cataclysmic Atlantis, and is substituting for Zaius because Zaius cannot act or interact directly with either the Earth or the peoples on Earth. So Cleese is his instead. Cleese is trying to do things and Moloch is trying to stop him. Along the way, directly working for Moloch is Xersa. Directly working for Xersa is Horjax. That's her muscle. Eric Cleese has a variety of people on his side. He has Slag, and he has a mandrel, the monkey mandrel-looking dude, and they encounter a species of Fey, well, multiple species of Fey in the forest, and all of them have different forms and different names and things like that. So Eric is journeying around trying to gather up forces for good to battle Moloch. Now we find out that Moloch is not the main bad. Moloch is working for Orcus, who Orcus seems to be on the same level as Zaius, but working from hiding for evil, where Zaius is out obvious working for good. So Cleese is trying to rally people and creatures and what have you on Atlantis. I would assume he's on Atlantis. He's on the Earth somewhere. And this Xyrsa sends Horjax to fight and preferably kill Eric Cleese. Well, Eric makes the makes the meeting here with the Fae people, and there's every Fae that is drawn here is of a different species. Unicorns and different were creatures and trolls and ogres and fairies, oh my. So, in the midst of this meeting, Horjax catches up with him, and he's a cyclops, a cyclopean race at the very least. And Eric Cleese, for those of you that didn't listen or don't remember from the first issue, basically hulked up to be unto Hercules when he was transported from current to the past. That was what Zaius did to him to allow him to do these things. So Eric Cleese is Hercules traveling around. So Hercules, Eric Cleese, is fighting this big cyclopean dude and finally kicks him off a cliff here as they're fighting. Well, everybody is glad that the big cyclops is gone, except for Xyrsa. She gets word that her man has been killed by Cleese, and she is quite upset about it and is about to send more forces after Eric, but someone in the Fae retinue knew where Horjax had come from, that he was a minion of Xyrsa. Told Eric, so Eric took all of his companions and the Fae that had joined forces with him to Xyrsa's castle. And just as she gives the command for more badness to go out and try to kill Cleese, he crashes her castle and invades, and there's a big fighty fight and everything, and his forces overcome her forces, and then he goes face to face with her, which she quickly bows out. She is a sorceress. She is not a physical fighter. So using guile and good looks and whatever, she draws Cleese closer until he encounters this creature that looks like a fur rug in her boudoir, but turns out that it has some kind of tentacles, and it wraps itself and it like surrounds him and starts to eat him like if you just threw a rug over somebody's head and then it started to digest them underneath the rug, right? That's what's happening only with tentacles. That's what's happening to Cleese. He finally manages to get enough leverage that he pulls it far enough away that he just rips it in half and splashes ichor and gore and blood everywhere. And now he's covered in this and he goes to attack her, Xyrsa, but she disappears. So he then joins up with the rest of his companions and the Fae as they push their attack and defeat all of the forces in Xyrsa's castle. As they party and rejoice and much rejoicing, yay, they're being watched by this Orcus dude who is watching from wherever he is in the shadows. We're told a vast subterranean cavern. So he's watching from the shadows. We don't see him or get a good view of him or anything like that. And because of that, I want to believe that this is probably going to be Zaius also. But I don't know that for sure. Maybe not. Because we really haven't seen Zaius since he sent Cleese on this mission. So we don't know much about him. We cut back to Moloch just in time to see him take out a couple more Althea doppelgangers. But his advisor has another plan that involves the Black Swamp to use to destroy Eric Cleese. So that is something that we can look forward to coming up. Now, the last couple pages, very confusing. We're told even as the trio discusses its next move, they are being discussed by a sinister congress of the outcast overlords and their subordinates. Now, the trio is Cleese and Slag, and I didn't catch it anywhere, whatever the mandrel's name is. Those are the three primary good guys trying to get all of the forces of good together, gathering the forces. So while they are traipsing off in the jungle on their next sortie to find good guys to join the cause. They are being discussed by a group of 4, 10, 11, 12, 13, every face in in 5 panels here is a different individual. So all of these are overlords of other groups of people on Atlantis or on the planet Earth, whichever we're dealing with. And so they are remaining kind of neutral between this fight between Zaius and Moloch. They want to stay out of the way because they individually don't have the power to overcome either one. Apparently, together, they still don't seem to possess the power to overthrow Zaius or Moloch and take over that aspect of the fight between good and evil. So they're kind of caught in between, not really knowing who to throw in with, but watching everything very carefully. And so they are talking, planning what they can do to try to interfere, at the very least, with what Cleese is doing and not gather up all the people together who agree with Zaius. And that is where we leave the story. So, I'm, like I said, I'm not overly a fan. Yeah. So, next full page spread here for Darklon the Mystic, which is coming up, I believe, next season also. I might discuss the first one before this current season is up, which just runs through the end of the year, our actual year. So there's only, one more? I think there's only one more Pacific Comics episode after this series of shows that I do. So he's coming up soon, but I don't remember exactly where. Jack Kirby, next page. Jack Kirby delivers a 1-2 punch. We have the Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers special number 1 next season. And Silver Star number 6, definitely next season, advertised here. Next up is The Rescue. Scripts, penciled, and inks by Tom Burgard. So we have a warrior here. He's got armor. He's got gauntlets and whatever it's called that covers the knee and shin. There's a name for that section of the armor. Leather breeches. He's partially armored, kind of looking or attempting to look rather badass, kind of. He's all covered with gore and ichor because he's been fighting this big battle with his big sword and everything. And he gets done and he starts to chase after the enemy that has been routed. But he finds that his woman, Aradne, is nowhere near him. She was fighting with him, but she has disappeared. So he looks around the battlefield and does not see her anywhere. So he figures that she has been kidnapped and follows after the retreating army, pursuing them on foot day after day after day. He follows them to their castle, which to enter their castle, they go through the gaping maw of a skeleton of some dread beast. He follows them inside. He sees his woman. She is being led around towards some sort of torture device over here on the other side of the room. He comes in just in time, kills a couple of the guards, and then screams, "Release her!" And you see his woman, his love, Aradne, and another woman here, and they turn around. He throws his sword at the human woman of the two and kills her. And what is left is this large, furry, creaturous, beastie-looking thing, which turns out to be Aradne, because he gets up on tiptoes and kisses her in a manner that her mouth could, like, engulf his entire head and suck him dry. So, a little bit of a twist there as to who you assumed. And the evil queen or the evil woman was drawn, you know, rather attractively, blonde, long blonde hair. So you thought it was her. No, it's the creature that was with her. On sale now, Vanguard Illustrated Issue 1, next season. I'm sorry, I'll quit saying that. And then we see the final story, Scaling the Heights, scripted, penciled, and inked by Adam Kubert, colored by Pal Tallarday and Barbara Marker. This does not really bear any resemblance to Adam Kubert art that I'm familiar with. I'm familiar with stuff that he did much later in his career, apparently, on X books. That's my Adam Kubert knowledge. So it's a couple little creatures dressed in blue and green here trying to scale something. One, two, three, four, five horizontal panels, but the horizontal panels aren't the borders of the panels aren't perpendicular with the page. They're wedges, and the wide side of a wedge, the panel below it is the narrow side of that next wedge. So it's a large to a small from left to right, and then the next panel is small to large, and it alternates like that for five panels. So visually interesting. Scaling the Heights, like I say, is the name of it. The two individuals, they're connected together, it looks like, yeah, but they're also scaling independently. They pass in one panel something that looks like maybe nostrils on a nose, and then they're climbing. They go past this squishy, sludgy, moving section. But then as they're climbing, one of them gets stuck in like a landslide of this viscous material, and it pulls the other off of what they're climbing on, and they both fall, and splat. And we see that what they were scaling is a candle, the wax being melted and running, and the candle is sitting in a candle holder that is shaped like a face. So it was nostrils that they climbed by, and when they climbed past the candle holder to the actual wax, they succumbed to the melting of the wax because it's a lit candle and plummeted to their death. Inside back cover is Edge of Chaos, issue number 3. And then the back cover itself on sale soon, Jeff Jones's Ravens and Rainbows. So those are more books that we have to look forward to. So there we go, guys. That is part one of this month's episodes. Part two, I will be looking at Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné, number 3. Sergio Aragonés' Grew the Wanderer, number 4. And the Joe Kubert School Presents First Folio. Now, I haven't looked at that folio. I don't know if there's going to be stories much to talk about, or if it's just artwork, or what exactly it is. But I will be more than happy to tell you next time out. Talk to you guys then. Ciao.